McFerrin burst onto the bridge. "Have any ships responded to our Mayday call?" he asked Sheffield. Sheffield stared blankly. "Mayday? Didn't you give our position and request immediate assistance?" "Yes, we must send out a call for help," Sheffield muttered vaguely. McFerrin immediately read the incoherence in Sheffield's tone and eyes and was horrified. "Oh, God, it's probably too late. The flames must have reached the radio room." He snatched up a phone and called the radio room, but heard only static. 12 miles to the south, a pair of opaline green eyes gazed into the brightening sky to the east before turning and examining the red glow on the northern horizon. Absorbed, the man stepped from the bridge wing into the pilot house of the Numa Oceanographic Survey Vessel Deep Encounter, picked up a pair of strong binoculars, and returned. Slowly, deliberately, he focused the glasses and stared into the distance. He was a tall man, 3 inches more than 6 feet, and a lean 185 pounds. His every movement seemed consciously planned. The black hair was wavy, almost shaggy, with a touch of gray beginning to show on the temples. The tanned skin and the craggy features revealed a love of the outdoors. As Special Projects Director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency, Dirk Pitt spent 9 months of each year at sea. On this expedition, the NUMA scientists were conducting a deep-water geological survey in the Tonga Trench. After studying the glow for 3 minutes, he retraced his path into the pilot house and leaned into the radio room. "Have you picked up any distress signals in the last hour?" The operator shook his head.
"I had a short conversation with the radio man on board a British container ship around 1 o'clock, but no distress signal."
"A large ship off to the north looks like it's on fire. See if you can make contact with her." Pitt touched Leo Delgado, the officer on duty, on the shoulder. "Leo, I'd like you to turn the ship north and proceed at full speed. I believe we have a ship on fire. Wake Captain Birch and ask him to come to the pilot house." Though Pitt was head of the project and outranked Birch, the captain still commanded the ship. Kermit Birch came almost immediately, wearing only a pair of polka-dot shorts.
"What's this about a ship on fire?" he asked Pitt, suppressing a yawn.
Pitt explained what he had seen. Birch grinned.
"You gave the same order I would have given."
He stepped over to the ship's phone.
"Engine room, rouse Marvin out of bed. I want every revolution he can get out of the engines."
After the news went out, the survey ship came alive as crew and scientists were assigned special duties. The ship's 2 35-foot hydrographic survey launches were made ready to drop in the water. Slings were attached to the 2 telescoping deck cranes used to raise and lower submersibles and survey equipment so that people could be pulled from the water. Every ladder and rope on the ship was coiled to be thrown over the sides along with cradles to lift children and the elderly on board. The ship's doctor, with the assistance of the marine scientists, prepared the hospital and a casualty station in the mess room. Officers instructed crewmen to channel survivors onto different parts of the ship to be cared for, as well as act as ballast. If the hoard that was expected to come on board was not placed strategically to balance the ship, it could roll over and capsize. The Deep Encounter was only rated at a top speed of 16 knots, but Chief Engineer Marvin House pulled every ounce of power from his 2 big 3,000-horsepower diesel-electric propulsion engines. 17 knots became 18, then 19, until the bow was thrusting through the sea at 20 knots. Captain Birch ordered the radio operator to contact other ships in the area. There were only 2 within 100 miles. One was the Earl of Wattlesfield, the British container ship the radio operator had contacted earlier. Her captain had quickly responded and was coming at full speed, but he was 37 miles to the east. The second vessel was an Australian missile cruiser that had changed course and was charging toward the position given by Birch, but she had 63 miles to go. Satisfied there was nothing left to consider, Birch joined Pitt on the bridge wing. Every soul who did not have a duty to perform lined the rails, staring at the red glow lighting the sky. 70% of the once beautiful ship was a vortex of flames. Already, her superstructure was a twisted, seething tangle of red-hot steel that virtually divided the ship in two. The interior support bulkheads had contorted into a mass of melted and scorched metal. The lifeboats, or what was left of them, hung in their davits, barely recognizable.
"Good Lord," mumbled Birch.
"No one got away in the boats."
Their first impression was that nobody could have been left alive in such a holocaust. But then the great mob of people became visible, choked together on five of the liner's open stern decks. At the sight of the deep encounter, a steady stream of them began to leap into the water and swim to water. Birch leaned over the railing and shouted an order to his crew.
"Away the boats! Get to those people before they float out of sight!"
"Can you bring Deep Encounter under the stern?" asked Pitt.
"You mean put our ship alongside?"
"Yes."
Birch looked skeptical.
"I won't be able to get close enough for them to jump on board."
"The nearer the fire gets to them, the more we'll leap over the side. Hundreds will die before we can pick them all out of the water. If we tie up to the stern, her crew can throw lines for the passengers to slide down to our deck."
Birch looked at Pitt.
"In this sea, we'll beat hell out of Deep Encounter against that monster. Our hull plates will be crushed and open to the sea. We could easily sink ourselves as well."
"Better to try and sink alongside than never to try at all," Pitt said philosophically. "I'll take full responsibility for the ship from my end."
"You're right, of course," Birch agreed. He took over the helm and began orchestrating the controls of the two omnidirectional Z-drives and jet bow thrusters of the survey ship, gently nudging her starboard hull sideways against the massive stern of the Emerald Dolphin.